Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, and to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, and Delilah Jones of Imagine Publicity, my co-host this evening. So I want to say good evening, everyone, and welcome, and happy Memorial Day weekend. And we're very glad to have you here once again, as always, on Saturday evening. And tonight is no different than any other night in terms of bringing you what I think are two spectacular guests this evening. And we just have had some incredible topics, some incredible personal stories. And before we bring our guests on, I want to say good evening, Delightful Delilah. How are you? Come on board and let's chat a bit.
Hi, Donna. I'm doing great, as usual. We're taking the show in a little bit of a different turn tonight, and I think, you know, it's definitely a story that needs to be told. I know that our guest has been the subject of a documentary, and there has been a lot of news coverage in the New England area, but I don't know that it's really a nationally known story, and it really needs to be, because it's got a very, very important message that I hope all of our listeners will stay tuned and pick up on it.
Yeah, definitely. And so that I don't forget, please do remind us, this gentleman, Kobe Salerno, and his mom, Kelly, are our guests from Connecticut. And the aspect that's so unique as well is that he was able to capture our minds and our hearts through the social media vehicle of blogging. And I think that's really unique, too. And that has a direct relation to your company, what you do for your living. And it's just fascinating to me as well. There's so many layers to this story. So without ado, I say, Colby and Kelly, good evening. And thank you so much for joining us on Shattered Life. It's an honor and a pleasure to have you.
Good evening. Thank you for having us.
Oh, it's our pleasure, and happy Memorial Day, and thank you for sharing your holiday with us. So, first of all, I think for people that have read the promo, they know a little bit, a skeletonized version, shall we say, of your story. But basically, we want to tell your story from your perspective, Colby, as a heart transplant recipient, and from the mom's perspective, and also what's really important to you in terms of the cause that you're championing. And so do you want to start out a little bit by just telling us a little bit of your status prior to your transplant, maybe your childhood and young adult? And also there's a significance in this date, too. Let's not forget about the anniversary. So, Colby, do you want to start off, or you want to hand it over to mom? Either one of you.
Yeah, I'll start.
Okay.
So when I was really young, I played soccer. I was on three competitive soccer teams, but I struggled to keep up with my teammates. When it came to running and endurance, I struggled mightily. I was first diagnosed with sports-induced asthma, which we later discovered was a misdiagnosis. I got lucky enough that an intern doctor thought he heard a sound in my heart, which led us to see a cardiologist. When I went to see her, I was 12 years old and was diagnosed with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, at which point I had to quit all competitive sports, which was really tough at the time to take. At that time, I ended up kind of just wondering what was going on with my heart and stuff. And that's when I decided that I was only like 14. I decided I wanted to be a doctor. I went through high school and college with only minor difficulties. I had two pacemakers installed as precautions in case something would happen. I graduated from St. Michael's College in Vermont and with a Bachelor of Science in Biology, again in hopes to become a doctor one day. After I graduated, though, I had come clean with my doctor that my symptoms were getting much worse, and I didn't know why. I didn't know what was going on. So I went to Boston to Tufts Medical Center to meet a specialist in my disease. So he specialized in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and he ran the tests necessary to try and really figure out what was going on. When I had gone there, I kind of had hopes that he would have, you know, these minor procedures that I had done research on that would fix my heart really fast. However, when he came into the room, he informed me that that my heart kind of was giving out. I was in heart failure, and eventually I was going to need a heart transplant to save my life. So that was in towards the end of 2010. And then by September 2010, I was listed for heart transplant. After that, again, I was just told to kind of go home and go about my business and wait for the call that I got a heart. Eventually, however, the symptoms would continue to worsen. My heart was just not able to pump the blood throughout my body the way that a normal person my age would need in order to live their everyday life. So eventually I was double listed for a heart transplant at Tufts Medical Center and at Hartford Hospital in Hartford, Connecticut. When it came time that I was so sick I had to be admitted into the hospital in December 2011, I decided to be admitted at Hartford Hospital so that I could be closer to home.
Right.
So eventually I would go on and I lived at Hartford Hospital for 6 months, and on Memorial Day 2012, which is why this weekend is such an important weekend to me and my family. So Memorial Day 2012, I got the call from my surgeon, and he informed me that a heart was available and that I would be having my transplant the next morning.
I can't imagine that feel. So what's it like looking back a year ago now? And I can't imagine that you were you elated, relieved? Was there a combination? And, you know, and then also tell me, what was that like for you?
Yeah. So like I said, I, you know, or like you said, I meant, you said that I wrote a blog. And so kind of in that moment, I told the world or whoever was reading my blog at the time, like how I felt. And the truth is that you feel numb because you feel so many emotions at once. It kind of just numbs the senses, because although I was happy, I was elated, I was all of that, I was also scared. The next morning I would be, I had to try and sleep, and then the next morning I would be waking up knowing that they were about to take my heart out and replace it with someone else's. And then I also had to get over the idea that that means someone young enough that their heart was viable for me had just passed away in order for me to receive that heart. But in the end, I knew that, you know, things happen for a reason. I was getting the gift of life, and that I was going to move on and do great things with it. And that at that point, I just knew I needed to get home and get out of that hospital. It had been 166 days living in a hospital at that point. And I just knew I had to go and get on with my life and try and help others the way that my doctors had helped me.
Wow.
If I can interrupt for just a second, just for the benefit of us and the benefit of the listeners, can you go back to the beginning? Can you explain the disease that your heart had? You can say it much better than I can. Explain what that is and what sort of symptoms that maybe someone else has that they don't understand or realize what's going on in their own body.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So my disease, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, is actually the leading cause of sudden death in young athletes. That being said, because most don't know they have it, and due to the disease, it's a mutation in your genome, the heart muscle is the cells are not aligned correctly. You have a lot of scar tissue and things like that. So the electrical signaling of the heart does not go through the heart the correct way, which can cause arrhythmias, which at which point can cause death, because you go into cardiac arrest, and if a defibrillator is not nearby, it can quickly kill you. That's why I had the two pacemaker defibrillators installed when I was only 14 years old.
And am I right that there typically are no, I was reading up on it a little bit, that there are no symptoms that you feel?
That can be the case. The reason I needed the heart transplant is that although the disease is rare in itself in a way, I had an even rarer form of the disease. So because my heart was doing so bad, I had so much scar tissue build up in my heart that it kind of was just, my heart was working so hard to make up for that, it was just wearing itself out. So my heart was kind of performing the way an 80-year-old man's heart would perform. And so when I would try and play soccer and stuff, it got to the point where I would have to lay down on the ground. I lost my vision, my hearing. My legs were too weak to go on, things like that. When I was in college, I lived on the fourth floor of a dorm my sophomore year, and there was no elevator. So by the time that I would get to the second floor, I could barely breathe and would have to take a break there before getting to my room. And then eventually what really got me hospitalized was that it got so bad that even when I would eat large meals, the shunting of blood to my gut would make me so tired and winded because my heart wasn't able to compensate for that.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's just incredible. Kelly, can you tell us what your feelings were going at the point when they discovered, you know, that a heart was available, and just in terms of how do you kind of keep the family flow going and coping through all of these changes?
It just took me by surprise hearing Colby mention that moment again, because it's going to be a year just now, this weekend, and we were with Colby that night, and we left the hospital, and I walked out of the hospital with my husband, Colby's dad, and one of Colby's nurses, and I said to her, gee, you know, I think we're going to be here for 4th of July, and Colby had already spent his birthday, Christmas, Easter, St. Pat, he had spent almost every holiday in there already, and I just said, okay, well, we're going to be spending 4th of July. And we were in the ramp garage, and we were on our way home, and we no sooner were on the highway, and my phone lit up, and it was Colby. It said Colby, and I looked at my husband, and I said, oh, my God, he never calls when we just leave. This must mean something. And I answered the phone, and he was crying, and he said, Mom, I just got the call that this is really it. And I said, Colby, are you sure? And he said, yes, this is it. So my husband and I immediately turned right back to the hospital. We got our daughters on the phone. They met us there. And I was very scared because I knew he was going in for major surgery the next day. But I also knew that we were getting really tired and we were worn out from being in the hospital every day for so long. And Colby is the reason that I think we all hung on as well as we did. People tell me all the time how strong I am, but Colby's the one that it was like only 3 days after he was admitted that he started to blog, and it was called Tales from the 10th Floor because he was in on the 10th floor of intensive care in Hartford Hospital, and he never, like, he always wrote inspirational blogs, and I would be home in the morning, and before I go to the hospital, I would look to see if Colby blogged, and if Colby blogged, I knew that everything was okay, and it was when he didn't blog that I really got worried, because I have to tell you, in 166 days waiting for that heart, there was only one day that Colby had pretty much of a meltdown. Other than that, the kid who was the youngest on the floor, everybody else was much older. He just kept everybody going besides not just us, but all other family members, all patients, friends. He just had such a way with himself that I used to say, where did you come from? Because I don't understand how well you're handling this.
Yeah, well, you know, we all think that we don't have enough strength to deal with whatever it is we do. And, you know, I just think that you must be so, it sounds like you are so proud of him. You were, and you are, and you remain so. And it is so, so inspiring. But in terms of the actual blog, Colby, when did you make the decision to have that sort of be your lifeline? And what kind of impact was that on other people, and did it spread like wildfire? And I think I understand some of it's still online, isn't it?
Yeah, it's still up. I really haven't written much. I mean, my inspiration was living in the hospital and trying to, you know, tell everyone out there what it was really like to, you know, live in a hospital for that long. Now that I'm out, I don't find my life as interesting, I guess you could say. I don't see these little things that I find worthy of a blog post. But when I started it, I honestly can't even tell you what made me start it. It was more of I had a good belief that I was going to be there for a while. They say on average when you're in the hospital, the wait is 3 months. So I figured 3 months was going to be the least amount of time I would be in there. So I was kind of prepared for that, and I kind of was like, well, how am I going to communicate with, like, the outside world, I guess, and let them know what was going on? And I decided to turn to a blog and felt that was a good way to tell everyone what was going on with my life. And so when I wrote it, it was kind of just for my friends and family to see what things were like, what life was like for me. What made it take off, I couldn't tell you. It's just word of mouth, I guess, but it's been viewed well over 54,000 times now.
Wow.
It won an award in Connecticut. It was given the award for the best overall and the best health blog of 2012 in Connecticut.
Who awarded that?
It was Webster's and the Hartford Current. So it was a huge vote in the state of Connecticut. It's pretty much just people that, you know, read blogs and stuff like that that voted it as the best. Mm-hmm. And when I started writing it, like I said, it was for friends and things. And then once I realized it was spreading, the news crews started to come to interview me. The news crews came by to give me my awards when I won. And I realized the amount of people that it was reaching. And that's when I really used it to spread the idea of how important organ donation was. Anytime I spoke to organ donation doctors, they say, you know, the biggest issue is that not enough people are signed up to be donors and stuff like that. And I wanted people to realize, you know, what I was going through, how organ donation helped and how it was organ donation that was going to save my life. And then just the idea that, you know, so many people believe so many bad things about organ donation that just aren't true. And I thought if I could reach even one person and change their mind about it, that would be good enough for me.
Mm-hmm. Kind of to have to dispel the myths, which is so important. Can both you and your mom talk about a couple of things? I want you to talk about Donate Life, which is your, you know, which is the mission to try to help raise funds for other people. But with respect to you having the availability of someone else's heart, is that my understanding? Is that's one reason why there's so few donations? Is that when people approach you in the hospital, it's at the most vulnerable time of their lives when someone's passing away and they're asking to provide organs. And talk about that a little bit. And was that done? Do you have an idea of how that was done? How do they approach families who they know are passing away? How was that process conducted, and what was it like? Do you think for them as well as for you?
I mean, I can't say for sure because I haven't been in that situation myself.
Right.
However, in my documentary, there was a time where I sit down and I interview one of my friend's mom myself. My friend was hit by a drunk driver right before I was listed for heart transplant, and he passed away, and he saved 5 people with his organs.
Mm-hmm.
So I sat down and I had a talk with her about how, you know, how it's done. the mother of a son who was an organ donor and things like that. And she explained to me that I believe the protocol has changed over the years in order to try and make it the best as possible, because like you said, these people who are traumatized, and then someone's walking in asking if they can take their loved one's organs, which is just an extremely hard thing to do, and it's an extremely hard thing to do on those who are asking as well. So from now on, it's done face-to-face. They send in a representative from either Donate Life or Life Choice or some sort of organization that is, a staple to whichever hospital you're in. And my friend's mom explained it as someone came in from Donate Life. They were as sweet as could be, she said, and they explained, you know, they know how terrible it is what my friend's mom was going through. The idea, though, is that they know what good can come from it. They've seen it. They know that although he has passed away and how horrible that is, he has the chance, or the family has a chance, to make the decision to save many others that are out there waiting. And that's kind of what me and my mom has developed. My mom is now a board member on Donate Life due to our story being picked up and them realizing, you know, what we've been through as a family. And the idea is, you know, something terrible has happened. And if an organ donation occurs, it probably means someone has passed away far too soon. Whatever tragic event occurred, and it's kind of like you have to try and look at the silver lining, and the silver lining is this tragic thing occurred, but now they have the ability to save 5 to 8 people by giving them a second chance at life. And the thing is with us is that we realize it has to be talked about sooner. I thought about what would have occurred if I passed away, and if someone came in and asked my mom if they could have my organs. And I could see it now, my mom freaking out and saying, you're not touching, you know, my son, you're not taking his organs from him. Obviously, that wouldn't happen now because she knows how important it is. But before all this occurred, that probably might have happened. It's trying to get the discussion started beforehand so that people make this decision before anything ever occurs, and say that some circumstance occurs, which I would never hope on anyone. I would love for everyone to live to be 100 and stuff like that, but it just doesn't happen. So when you have that occur and you have the conversation, that way when someone comes in, the conversation does not need to be had. They don't have to ask your traumatized loved ones if they'll donate the organs. You made the decision while you were alive, and so they know that that is what's coming next. Right now,
and
I'm
timing.
An organ donor now.
Yeah.
So if I were to pass away, they wouldn't even go to my family. I don't know how it is in the country, but in Connecticut, it's the law that now that I'm an organ donor, my family can't overturn it. So I would know passing away that my organs are going on to save others.
Yeah. Kelly, can you talk about your experience with being on the board? And maybe just so I don't leave it to the end, I don't want to run out of time, can you please do give us contact information if people would like to look into it with regard to their organs, or give financial donation to the cause as well? Can you address that for us?
Yeah. Oregon, you can sign up, like Colby said, you can go on DonateLife.net, and basically if you go online and you sign up, you pick exactly what you want to donate. You can choose to be a tissue donor. You can it's all legal right through the internet. And I know that in, like Colby also said, I know in Connecticut, once you're an organ donor, your family can't overrule it, but that's not the case with every state in the country. So say someone wants to be an organ donor, they need to make sure their family is aware that that's their wishes, because if you're in a state that a family can overrule it and something happens to you, say you're in a car accident or something tragic happens, they can go to the doctor and they can say, no, we're not going to do that. We don't want you to take their organs. This is the way it is. So it's very important to, number one, become an organ donor. Number two, depending on what state you live in, you discuss it with your family. Because
right.
it could be overruled in a lot of the states still.
Well, does it make a difference, say you were in, I don't know, Ohio, and you were in a car accident there, but you're from Connecticut. What does it depend upon what you're the resident of whichever state, and that takes priority over, you know, in terms of the laws?
I would believe, I think that one, I've never been asked that before. I would say that it's definitely probably the Connecticut law, because we all signed up in Connecticut and through Connecticut. But Colb, do you think, I have to tell you, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that either, because I know if you sign up in Connecticut, you know, your heart says, I would love for my organs to go to someone in Connecticut. I think just due to viability of organs and things, if I was out in some other state, like you said, Ohio, I think where I passed away at the hospitals I was at, those hospitals would most likely get my organs first. I don't know for sure, again, but I think that is how it's worked, that it's about giving the best organs possible away, and taking the time to bring mine to Connecticut might not be the best option. And
right.
For me, I mean, this is just my personal opinion. If I were to pass away, I wouldn't care which state, my organs ended up with. I would just be happy, you know, maybe in heaven somewhere, wherever it may be, that someone was living on because of the choice
that
I made.
Somebody got them. Yeah, and that's the important part, and it is true. And can people give financial donations too as well? Unless they're still thinking about the organ donation, is there a way that they can give money as well?
I know on DonateLife.net, that's where you go to sign up to be an organ donor. They have an area where you could click on your state, sign up right in your state.
Right.
Again, that's DonateLife.net. And I haven't been on the website in a while. That's where I signed up myself, was on that website. I wasn't looking at the time for money donations, but I would have to think somewhere on there. I know they have areas where you could sign up to volunteer at Donate Life events, things like that. So I can't see where there wouldn't be an area to donate to that organization.
Right. And Kelly,
yes, because
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's a nonprofit organization, so I know that donations are always welcome.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I was wondering too. You know, a lot of us, I have spastic cerebral palsy, and I don't know whether, because of the spasticity, all of my organs would be necessarily, although I'm very healthy, the greatest. So do you recommend that you consult with your physician with regard to, yes, I like the concept of doing this, but I don't know which organs would be best for me to designate. Is that a question that comes up and you should talk to your own MD?
I don't know.
It's
not necessary, because whatever you sign up to give, every single organ, tissue, everything is going to just be completely looked at by the doctors. If they find even something minor that might cause issues, there's a good chance they won't use that organ. Or if there's an issue, they're going to consult the recipient first about whether they would be willing to accept that organ. If, say, like, for example, if my donor had hepatitis, they would have come to me and been like, your donor had hepatitis, would you be willing to accept this organ anyways? Say if you're really sick, there's a good chance that you're going to be willing to accept it anyways. If you know that, you know, you have a little bit longer to wait and stuff, you'll say, no, I'll wait for the next better organ that's available. So they're going to really, really scrutinize any organ. So you really don't need to specify anything like that. You could say, I'm willing to give everything, or you can say, you know, maybe don't take so-and-so just because personally you feel you wouldn't want to give that up. But as for if you think you're medically worried, the doctors during organ donation will take care of that.
Right, I see. Well, you know, that might be a good segue, and then I want to throw it over to, Delilah in a minute. With regard to the person that donated your heart, now that their heart was totally healthy, or you know, you didn't have any other sort of other diseases attached to that, correct?
Yeah, I mean, there's always the thing. So I just got a virus when I was over in Pennsylvania for graduate school. The virus ended up coming from my donor heart, but things like that happen because it's just a virus that, you know, it wouldn't affect a healthy human, but because I am immune suppressed, my donor had this, you know, disease growing up or whatever, and, you know, it never affected them. Now that I have that heart, it was able, you know, it was in the heart cells and was able to work its way into my system, and due to my immune suppression, you know, I had to deal with this virus, but I was given medications, and I'm feeling excellent now. So things like that can happen, but
you're talking a childhood illness that the donor might have had?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, the donor had a virus called CMV. It's called cytomegalovirus, and it's just a virus that can easily be picked up in the next, you know, in just the human population. And if you're mm-hmm. a healthy adult, the chances of it affecting you is very, very slim. So most adults, humans, they just wouldn't know they have it. But because of my immune suppression, it was able to, you know, make its way into my system, and I became symptomatic just because my body couldn't fight it off the way a normal person's would.
Yeah. Oh, I see. So it was just identified at that point in time when you were in Pennsylvania?
Yeah. I got really sick. You know, right around Easter time, I was having fevers and stomach mm-hmm. issues and stuff like that. So I had to go to the hospital, and through blood work and stuff, they were able to identify the virus and treat it with the correct antiviral medications. And, you know, now I'm good to go.
Well, that's wonderful. We're so glad that that hasn't repeated itself in the last year. And can you please talk a little bit about the fact that there was a crime element to this story?
Yeah. So I don't know, you know, the full – so there's a certain way when you get an organ, you know, you have to go through certain channels in order to comment or to communicate, I mean, with the organ donor's family. In my situation, I had kind of really grown known in the state of Connecticut. You know, everyone in Connecticut really knew who I was. I was on the news much more than I would have ever expected. So when kind of things occurred that kind of tied things together, I guess you could say, that really made it become clear as to how I got my organ. When I got it, I had ended up getting it from an 18-year-old male, and now that I'm 25, I was 24 when I received my heart, so I was 6 years older than him. He was 18, and he had gotten into an argument while he was out playing basketball, and on his way home, he was assaulted and hit in the head, and eventually, when he was at the hospital and things, they confirmed that he was brain dead, and his family chose to donate his organ. So my heart came from the tragic crime of someone, you know, hitting someone else over the head and causing them to be brain dead.
Wow. How much information do they actually divulge to you about the donor?
They divulged. Technically, they divulged nothing. I was able to, you know, work my charm and get one of the doctors to admit that it was an 18-year-old and it was close by. That's all I was able to hear. Due to my situation and how the news was able to get a hold of certain information, they really know now that they should really tell me nothing and tell the donor family nothing. There's a certain way you're supposed to write letters through Life Choice and Donate Life, and that's how you go about contacting the family of your donor, and that's how you go about learning how they passed away and how they died and things like that.
That's the proper way, but that information kind of leaked out, right?
Correct.
I see.
Just certain people
our story,
Our story is extremely rare. And that was due to Colby's, Colby being in the news so much. Like, they never heard of this in donor history. That someone would figure out, like, who was their donor or vice versa. And and legally, we have never had it confirmed. This is all by the news that we know what we know.
And did you write about it in your blog, that aspect of it, Colby?
There was parts of it that I mentioned. You know, there was just some things that occurred, you know, that normally wouldn't occur with when people knew who I am. They unfortunately got the wrong idea that my family might be wealthy and stuff and that we should be helping out in certain areas. So I kind of just wrote a blog post letting people know, you know, that's not what organ donation's about. Organ donations, you know, about giving the gift of life. And, you know, you ended at that and that there's certain protocol to follow. And I think it's important to follow that protocol. It's in there. The protocol is written for a reason. So I kind of just, you know, mentioned that briefly, that that's the way it should be done. And so I don't mind that mine went wrong. You know, I think...
Well, it was a teaching moment, too, wasn't it, to kind of set people straight that you don't take advantage of the situation, you know, in that way, or, you know, you shouldn't, right?
Yeah, I think it was excellent to show this is not how it works. I think personally I have the personality that went well with it. I know some of my fellow heart transplant recipients, they might not have really been able to handle that situation. But for me, I find myself to be calm and, you know, patient and stuff like that. So I felt like, you know, it's no big deal. Things happen. And now the process in which it was done, they learned from that situation and can fix it to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Sure. Well, you know, I could see you being a national spokesperson. Delilah, do you have some things you'd like to ask?
Yeah, going back to the organ transplant protocol, so to speak, how is it determined who is the person who is most in need of that particular organ? Let's say, for instance, if there was a heart or a liver that comes available, who makes the determination of who gets that organ?
The doctors make the determination. They have, you know, so my doctor in Hartford, he has to go to meetings constantly with all the other doctors in the area. So that means Yale in New Haven and all the hospitals that are up in Boston. And they kind of discuss protocol and things. And it's pretty much there is a list, and it's whoever's at the top of the list in your organ area that gets the organ that they need. There's a certain protocol, so you get, you're either listed as status 2, status 1B, or status 1A. So organs pretty much most of the time only go to 1A patients due to the overwhelming number of people on the list, which currently sits somewhere around 117,000 people waiting for organs. Because
and is
so
1A the most serious, Colby?
Yeah, 1A is the most serious. That pretty much means you're in the hospital waiting for the organ. You need to be in the hospital watch constantly. That's what I was. If you're not 1A, chances are you're not getting an organ until you get sick enough to become 1A, because there's just too many 1A patients waiting. That's why it's, I don't know the exact number. It's something about certain number of seconds or minutes someone is dying while they're waiting for an organ.
And it's also about blood type. Your blood type is extremely important. Colby is a type O blood type. And
it's common, yeah.
And the problem with that is it's very good for anybody else, but when you're needing a heart transplant or an organ, it's not good, because O can give to anybody, but only O can give to O. So people that were in the hospital waiting, a lot of them went before Colby because they had type A, type AB. One of the biggest reasons for us waiting was because Colby was type O.
Because that's kind of the universal, type that you can give to anybody, so the more rare ones, they went first? Is that how
right,
did I interpret
only,
that correctly?
Only O can give to Colby, though. Like A, an O can give to an A, and an O can give to an AB, but only an O could match Colby.
As a donor, yeah.
Right, like he could not get an A from, he could, a person with type A couldn't give to Colby, a type B couldn't, or type
or
AB couldn't. And so the matching for Colby was harder than for, say, a patient who was a different blood type other than O.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It was
wow.
really, it's really how they match is really, really specific.
Mm-hmm.
And Colby
wow.
got a very perfect match.
Is that right? And it took those 2 years, correct? Is that right? Am I correct about that?
Yeah, he was listed on September 23rd, 2010, and he didn't get his heart till May 29th, 2012.
Well, in that time, what do you do then? Are you on a artificial heart machine all that time when you're in the hospital and it's pumping for you and you're just waiting? Or do they send some people home and tragically some people die, they don't make it? I mean, what happens in that intervening time when you're waiting?
It depends on your type of heart failure. They do have very sophisticated heart pumps. However, my heart, due to the thickness and things, I was not a candidate for one of those pumps. It would not fit or properly pump my heart. There are those that they're giving those hearts, they're called left ventricular assist devices, to pump your blood in your heart much stronger than your heart could do on its own. And they are sent home with those pumps to try and live and wait out until they get the call. I myself was on intravenous medication the entire time, three different types of IV medication that strengthened my heart pumping ability. Due to the medication I was on, however, you must be under doctor and nurse supervision the entire time. So that's what made me a 1A patient, is that it was not a type of medication that I could use at home. It was something that I had to have at the hospital in order to keep me alive while I waited.
Wow. Were you ambulatory in the hospital?
Yeah. Different hospitals have different protocol. Hartford Hospital does allow patients such as myself to get up and to walk around the nurse's station. I wasn't allowed to go outside or go to different floors or anything like that. I was just allowed to leave my room and walk around pretty much a desk. I kind of just did circles around a desk and just wheeled around my IV pole the entire time.
Mm-hmm. I've done that, but for another reason with IVs. Yeah, they're hard to manage. Kelly, can you tell us about what was the staff like and the support system there, and are there support groups for the transplant patients there at Hartford Hospital and throughout the nation? Is that typical?
Yes. First of all, the staff at Hartford Hospital, I can tell you, were beyond amazing. They've become friends of ours. Some of them have become almost like family. Colby didn't like the food at all at Hartford Hospital. There were nurses that brought him food. There were spouses of theirs that cooked for Colby. The doctors were magnificent. As a matter of fact, while he was sick in Pittsburgh, I have a cell phone number to his direct doctor, because things were not moving very well in Pittsburgh, so I just got on the phone, called the cell phone. He was on the phone with Pittsburgh within 5 minutes, and things turned around to get things done right. And
wow.
they just were so warm and comforting. And in my family, my husband, myself, my two daughters, and my son, we're not support group type people. We were offered it many times. There are support groups in every state in every hospital. We just do better speaking to ourselves or speaking to still the people at Hartford Hospital. That's just the way we are. If anyone ever had a hard time, I would definitely recommend it. I was in therapy all through it with a therapist here in my town and still am in therapy through it because I'm still, we went from one worry of waiting to see for them to save his life with a new heart to a different kind of worry now of germs and him catching different things and the fear of rejection. And so I still continue to see someone because I don't really know what it's like to have a child that's not sick. So
right. That's got to be a constant pressure on you and a constant worry and a stress. And are you able to do other, you know, to take your mind off of it at all? I mean, what other kinds of things do you do besides being a mom that is concerned about her son?
Well, I try. For the first 7 months after the heart came, we spent a lot of time going back and forth to Hartford Hospital because Colby needed biopsies and, you know, tests done, and it was once a week, and then he'd have blood draws, and then it went to every other week, and then it was once a month, but we still had doctor's appointments. There was still so much going on that it seemed like we were constantly busy. And then once we went to school, I'm involved in, I manage an over 30 soccer team that keeps me busy. I was just asked to help organize a premier team group for inner city children in New Haven. Some of my older soccer players that used to play on my team are starting this, and they just asked me if I would help do that. I helped lately with planning a few of our friends' weddings, you know, fun things that are all away from medicine. Because I personally was affected even before I had children. My brother got diagnosed with leukemia when he was 17, and I was his bone marrow donor, and he ended up dying at the age Colby is now. He died at 25. We've had medicine and situations in our life a lot. So I want to get away from that for a little while.
Yeah, I understand. Totally. You're talking a person with 57 surgeries here, so I can relate. I know what you mean. It's there in the background, but you don't want to make it your total focus of your life.
Right.
You know,
you want to be around something happy.
Well, yeah, it is, but the way your personalities are, I just, you know, I know you rise above and you reach out and you pay it forward and you help other people. You know what it reminds me of, too, Delilah, remember how we were talking with respect to when you go through a crime and you have to devote so much time to going to court and, as an example, parole hearing about a month ago, and you're a working person, and there's no provision for you taking time off to do those things normally. And I can't imagine how disruptive it would have been. I mean, I remember my mom, you know, devoting all of her life being up and visiting, you know, and dad up at the hospital so much. How, you know, all of these things, whether it's court, whether it's things in the healthcare system, you going through that with Susan and her cancer, it disrupts your life flow so much, and you have to devote so much time. Were people, Colby, were people, you and your mom and your circle of family and friends and employers, were they very good about you, you know, taking time off, or were you in danger of, you know, losing your job or whatever because this was so much a part of your life?
I mean, eventually I lost my job.
Was your job?
I'm trying to become a doctor, as I mentioned earlier. I was working as a tech in the emergency room of a hospital. So it was my job to draw blood and do EKGs and do things like that. So I was kind of just trying to gain on-the-job experience before applying, because I really couldn't apply to medical school until I got my heart transplant, it would have just disrupted everything, and I wasn't really able to leave the state of Connecticut for much longer, you know, than weekend trips to see friends and things. So eventually I lost my job, which is to be expected. I was living in a hospital for 6 months, and there was no way I was going to return to a job at an emergency room where it's just filled with germs. It just wouldn't be a good idea for me to have done at the time. So I was going to be out for far too long to keep that job. But I kept that health insurance. I'm paying COBRA right now through that. But they were great. They kept me on. They kept me on for a long, long time as an employee. So we were able to pay a much, much reduced price to keep me on their insurance. They didn't kick me off until I was already out of the hospital. So they kept me on as an employee for well over 6 months, really helping me out and do that. And, you know, things like wanting, you know, having people help me out and stuff, I'm just not that type of person. I went back to graduate school as fast as I was allowed to. I would have went back in the fall if it was possible due to my health, but it just wasn't. So I went back into a spring semester. I found one of the schools with a graduate program that worked like that. I'm just not the type of the person that needs handouts or needs people, you know, looking to help me, because I strive for bigger things than that. I want to be in med school as fast as I can. I want to be a doctor and help others that are going through what I went through as fast as I can. So even if people are willing to help, I just think you have to have the attitude, you know, I was given a heart, you know, my heart was failing. If this was like the 1970s or something, you know, I would have passed away. But due to today's technology, I'm going on living, and that's what I wasn't given a heart just to sit around and do nothing and get handouts. I was given a heart to live and do great things with it.
Yeah. What's your future?
I want you to know, though, we had a huge, huge circle of friends and family that have helped us. I quit my job in order to have to take care of Colby. My husband's job, they were okay. You know, they buy him when he needed time off, but there were, people had fundraisers for Colby. They really, really helped us a lot, because if Colby's insurance, because Colby, my husband works for a town and he's a Teamster, and even though the new law is you could keep them on your insurance for 26, Teamsters wouldn't cover, they didn't have to because they're self-funded. Colby, they didn't have to cover Colby's transplant for a year, including meds. And just two of Colby's meds a month, the two most important ones, $7,000 a month. So if we don't keep up the COBRA and the insurance for him from now on, then that's what we would end up paying. So we had a lot of help from friends and family.
Well, COBRA is extremely expensive as well, right? So
right. But it's you have no choice. You cannot go without insurance, because those meds, he's on, you know, 20 meds a day, and he's going to be on the anti-rejection med for the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the most expensive meds there is.
And do they predict that this, Colby, that this heart is going to work well for you for a long extended period? I mean, in terms of the long-term prognosis, what do they say?
As long as I take care of myself, the averages of heart transplant and how well, you know, you do after that is, you know, so up in the air, because, for example, say if I were, knock on wood, if I were to get in a car crash right now, they would say that my heart transplant only lasted a year. So when you read into the averages and they say, you know, hearts last 10 to 15 years, that could be because, you know, a bunch of older gentlemen or older women got hearts and things, and, you know, they passed away for different reasons. I have a firm belief that if I take the medication the way I'm supposed to, I exercise and I eat right and things like that, that this heart can go on for a very long time. Like my mom said, I haven't had my body has not rejected this heart yet. I try not to think about that. I just try to live my life, and if something comes up, I'll take it on. But I'm going to do everything in my power to try and avoid that.
Well, it sounds like you are. With respect to living every day, are there particular, other than, you know, trying to stay away from germs and that kind of thing and eat right, are there certain things you definitely can't do? You know, like you can't do strenuous sports and things like that, but you're just living just like any of us would?
No, I'm pretty much, if you were to meet me in person, you would never know. You would not know that I had a heart transplant. I go to the gym every single day, at which point, you know, I do a cardio workout and then I lift weights. So if someone saw me lifting weights, they would have never, you know, they'd look at me never, ever guessing that I had, you know, had a heart transplant less than a year ago and things like that. I started playing soccer again and things like that. So I went skiing this winter for the first time in my life. I never wanted to do it because of how bad my heart was, and I just knew that I wouldn't have stamina to do it, and I like to really do things 100%. So, yeah, if you looked at me, you would never know. And as for restrictions, it's pretty much, you know, wash my hands, stay away from germs, and you know, try and make sure I don't eat raw foods and things like that. Other than that, there's very, very little restriction that I have.
Well, that's tremendous. Tell us a little bit. We have about 2 minutes left with regard to medical school and what specifically you want to do once you get out of medical school.
When I got out of medical school, I'll definitely be moving into a cardiology field. When I was super young, I said I was going to be a pediatric cardiologist. I wanted to work with kids. I was a camp counselor and a camp director my whole, you know, once I was able to get a job. I loved working with kids. Right now, I'm not so sure. I really kind of want to work in transplant as well now, just because the whole process I thought was amazing, and just really what comes out of it is amazing. I'm not sure really where I'm ahead. I'm going to let med school, you know, take me down that road based on, you know, really working in that environment. Whichever environment I feel suits me the best is where I'll probably end up.
Yeah, wow, that's tremendous. You know, I really do hope that we can meet personally. We don't live that far away from each other, I don't think. And it's just so inspiring, and we're so glad to have you. Now, the theme of our show, the title is Shattered Life, and you have had one, but you've, again, turned this around just like so many other guests that we have had have been on, and it just does my heart so good to know. And I wonder, have a lot of people reached out to you, other heart patients, and would you do you want to be contacted by the public, or is there a way, are you continuing? I know you occasionally blog, you're very busy now with medical school, but if people did want to contact you, what's the best way, if at all?
Mostly I've gotten messages on Facebook. That's kind of been the main way people have contacted me.
Can you give us that?
Yeah, I mean, if you were to even just Google my name, Colby Salerno, I think, you know, you'd really see how much I pop up. But if you just search Colby Salerno on Facebook, I should come up. And, you know, and people, you know, I don't really... After my surgery, I got so many friend requests, I kind of just stopped taking them, you know, that I just, you know, I didn't know if people were friending me for the correct reasons, but, you know, you can send me a message before I even accept your friend request, and I've had patients do that.
Right. Well, I don't consider you just a one-time guest. Now we are friends, and I hope we can keep in touch, because we would like an update in the future. Would you try to keep in touch with us? Because I'd really like to stay in touch and let people know your progress.
Of course, that would be great.
Okay.
I'd love to call in one day and tell you I actually became a doctor.
Oh, we'll have to stay in touch. So with that, we're going to have to sign off for this evening, this hour show. Thank you so much, Kelly. Thank you, Colby. We will be doing a detailed blog tomorrow and embed the podcast. Thank you, Delilah. And please do tune in next week for another episode of Shattered Lives. Good evening,
everyone.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Okay, stay tuned. Bye-bye.